Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schloem. We have a couple of timely stories in this episode, literally. Later on, we'll find out how the recently launched Deep Space Atomic Clock will help future missions into space to navigate with a degree of accuracy and autonomy that's unprecedented. We'll talk to the principal investigator for the clock, Todd Ely. But first, we'll find out about a recent NASA article on their Global Climate Change website that spells out in detail just how small increases in average global temperatures will have dramatic and even catastrophic consequences for the planet's climate system as well as the ecosystems dependent on it. The article was written by our good friend NASA media specialist Alan Bias, and we'll talk to the scientist that helped him produce it, physicist and climate scientist Drew Shindell. He joins us from Duke University, where he's a senior professor of climate sciences. Dr. Shindell, welcome to Blue Dot.
Thanks for having me.
And I became aware of you through a friend of mine at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, who helps us land wonderful guests like you, Alan Bias. And he wrote a really well-done interactive article for the Global Climate Change site at NASA, and it's called A Degree of Concern: Why Global Temperatures Matter. So I wanted to talk to you about that and help us put into context the difference between, say, 1.5 degrees Celsius warming or 2 degrees Celsius warming, because for most of us, you know, that doesn't sound like a lot, but as it turns out, it's pretty consequential. So let's start out with, let's go back to last fall, this IPCC report came out, and you were involved in that, right?
That's right. I helped lead one of the chapters of that report.
And give us like the big takeaways from that report. Because as I recall, for me, when I heard about it, it was like, it sounds like things are much worse, or at least worse than we thought they were.
Well, traditionally, the countries of the world had been talking about limiting warming to 2 degrees. And they had been talking about that 10, 20 years ago when the planet had not warmed as much as it has today. So there was still a fair amount of room to go, right? We weren't all that close to it yet. And we would say things in IPCC reports, you know, I've worked on others in the past too. We would say things about how we have to change and we have to do a bunch of different things. But, you know, we can't say any one specific thing because, you know, we could do 7 out of these 10 options. And they have to be fairly soon, but if they're not very quick in the next decade, you could speed up in the following decade, right? We just had a lot of wiggle room. What's really different about this report is the planet has warmed up much more. The last several years in particular, warming has been so rapid that we're now past a degree. And we're thinking of 1.5 as an area where we should really be concerned because, again, we've seen the impacts of this rapid warming and we realize how quickly we get to dangerous territory. So now the big, I would say, big picture conclusion from the report was that with less than a half a degree to go, we can say it's not you do 6 out of these 10 things, it's you do all 10. And it's not, well, you could kind of make a half-hearted effort in the next decade and speed up later. It's you do all 10 and you do them in this decade or it is too late and we miss. So the conclusions that, you know, there's much less wiggle room. The conclusions are very firm. We need to be on a very different trajectory by 2030 than we are now. Or we can see clearly we'll pass 1.5 degrees and we can see what the consequences of that are. And they're not pretty.
Let's start out by talking about the sensitivity of human beings and natural systems to a warming climate. What are some of the major impacts that we see just from 1.5 degree warming?
Well, you're right. When you said before that it just doesn't sound like very much, does it? It's kind of a shame that we have to try to boil down, you know, as Alan's article shows, a whole world of different impacts in different places on different endpoints, and we boil that down to one number. So it doesn't sound like too much. 1.5 degrees, not such a big deal. But at 1.5 degrees, global mean annual average warming, most land areas of the planet have warmed a lot more than that, because land warms faster than the ocean. And so the ocean will have warmed less than a degree, and places where people lived will have warmed several degrees. Of course, this is all in Celsius, so it's almost double that in Fahrenheit. But if, you know, if you're in, say, the United States and you've warmed 3 degrees C, that's about 6 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's the average, but you might have warmed 8 degrees in the summer, and your summer heat extremes, you know, your hottest week or so might be 10 degrees hotter. And that's pretty hot if, like me, you live in a pretty warm place to start with. You know, here in North Carolina, an extra 10 degrees is not something we'd look forward to. The other impacts are, of course, it's not just the heat. We talk a lot about temperature. But temperature is an indicator of lots of other effects that we care about. And I would argue, really, that changes in rainfall are likely to have worse effects in many places, as the hydrologic cycle, it seems counterintuitive, but it gets more extreme at both ends. So we get both more droughts and more floods at the same time. The rainfall distribution is really pushed off to the edges. And of course, neither of those are good for crops. They're not good for keeping your basement from flooding. They're not good for keeping, you know, streets from going underwater. My town, we now have new signs to warn us when roads are flooded that, you know, we should go around and how deep the water is. It means more severe tropical storms. And when hurricanes come, which they inevitably do, it means they are more deadly than ever. And they drop more rain and they are more powerful when they come ashore. And it means rising sea levels, where the polar ice caps are really sensitive to these small changes. And we can tell from looking back in the Earth's history that at times in the past, when we have been only about 1.5 to 2 degrees warmer than pre-industrial, which is our reference in all this, that we have had many, many feet of sea level rise. So we've lost large portions of Greenland and Antarctica. And so we know that they are really sensitive, that it really makes a difference to them, and therefore to us, anybody that lives near the coast, it makes a difference whether it's 1.5 or 2, or of course 2.5 or 3. All, you know, there's nothing great about 1.5 or 2 in and of themselves. You know, 1.5 is better than 2, but 1.8 is also better than 2, and 2 is better than 2.5, et cetera.
Yeah, and it's, like you said, it's counterintuitive, but, you know, I've even noticed it in the past year or two that, you know, as we get rainfall, it seems that the precipitation is much heavier because the atmosphere is able to hold more water. And we saw the dramatic flooding in the Midwest and, you know, what kind of havoc that's dealing to the farmers there and their inability to get crops in the ground. And, you know, we haven't even gotten to what we're talking about with 1.5 yet. Could you just talk a little bit about how sensitive the Earth systems are to these temperature changes? Because it seems to me we're just starting to realize, you know, how sensitive the global thermostat is to the Earth's systems.
Well, I think that's very much the case. You know, back, and I worked on an earlier IPCC report about 10 years ago. And as I mentioned, you know, the planet had been warming more slowly at that time. And so we had, you know, maybe 3/4 of a degree of warming. But in the modern era where we have NASA and other great sets of observations, we only had 0.1, 0.2 degrees. And we couldn't really see exactly how sensitive things were. Now that we've warmed more than a degree and we have, you know, almost 0.3 or 0.4 degrees, so nearly half, within the modern period, we have seen some enormous changes. And the problem is that there are feedbacks sometimes that we don't expect, or there are multiple processes that work together. And so, for example, fires in Northern California, I'm sure that you know a lot about that, more than you'd like to. But of course, the conditions that make fire are a function of both the temperature and the rainfall. And so if you combine hotter temperatures with a lack of rainfall, which leads to vegetation that's more combustible, then you're more likely to trigger a severe fire. And so it's not a function of a single factor like temperature alone. Really, the danger is multiple effects combining. You know, another good example is there are many pests that get die out each winter. And all it takes is if you're near the freezing point, just a little bit warmer temperatures, and suddenly the insects that would start from almost nothing every spring are starting from, you know, having all of last year's growth. And you see this huge explosion in the population of certain pests and even certain types of wasps and bees and, you know, all kinds of things where nature is a complex system and it's not going to respond linearly when it is pushed. And we're getting more and more data about that. Ice sheets are another one where it's very nonlinear process, and we're seeing as temperatures warm, there are feedbacks where the ocean water gets under glaciers and undermines them and they slip. And as they slip, they self-lubricate and they flow faster and more flows behind it. And there's just this kind of domino effect where small changes lead to much, much bigger effects upstream.
Can you give us a sense of the time scale we're talking about here? When will we really start to see the dramatic effects of warming, say, at 1.5 to 2 degrees? Are we talking about out of about 2040, 2050?
Well, for 1.5, we are talking about somewhere in that range, about 20, 25 years from now on the current trajectory. It's going to be very hard to change that current trajectory, but with some luck and a lot of effort, we might be able to put off 1.5 for a while, or, you know, in an ideal case, that would be the maximum that we achieve, and it would be late in the century. The current trajectory will take us well past it, past that, and we would hit 2 also not that much further after, maybe about 2060s to 2070s. You know, we're on a course towards more like 4 by the end of the century. And so we are really heading into uncharted territory. And I would say we're already seeing some pretty severe consequences with things like the fires in California and heat waves in South Asia and elsewhere. And things like all of the really strong and extremely wet hurricanes that have been hitting the South.
Yes, and the flooding events in the Midwest.
Right, exactly. And there's just more and more around the world, you know, flooding in Japan and heat waves in Europe. And this is really becoming common over much of the planet.
We're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with atmospheric physicist Drew Schindel as we talk about the science behind the NASA Climate Website article, A Degree of Concern. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's continue now as we talk about climate change communication with Dr. Drew Schindel from Duke University. You've mentioned, and of course this has been in the news a lot, and I think there's a lot of misunderstanding about this, so I would like to you to address it and help us understand this, is we hear a lot about this 10-year window that we have. And, you know, sometimes that gets twisted around and simplified into the world is going to end in 10 years. You know, I've heard people say that. And that's not what it is at all. Could you explain to us what this decadal window that we keep hearing about, what is it and what does it mean?
Right. Well, yes, you're right. Fortunately, the world is not going to end in another decade. But, you know, we emit carbon dioxide as well as other pollutants, and they last for a long time. So people use the analogy of, say, turning an oil tanker, right? You've got to start turning early. And so if we do not really alter our current trajectory of how much we're emitting, which is a function, of course, of how we're using energy, where we're getting that energy from, we will not be able to stay below 1.5. Right, so we have a decade before we essentially lock in exceeding the 1.5 degree temperatures, at which we know there will be some pretty severe consequences.
What are the most severe of those consequences?
Well, I would say it's really water resources are some of the most severe, that millions of people will have difficulty accessing adequate fresh water, especially people in low-latitude countries. That's liable to cause a lot of strife in those kind of places, civil conflicts, migration from the global south to the global north, which could in turn lead to additional conflict. We're liable to see, well, almost certain to see continuation of the trend towards more and more destructive storms, where they both pack more power and pack more water, so the flooding gets worse. We would continue to see, and this is a slow timescale one, but a steady rise in sea levels with trouble for coastal areas and flooding and, you know, places like Miami or South Florida more generally, where this is bad, it's just going to continue to get worse and worse. And so these things are a kind of thing that you might be able to cope with the bulk of these consequences at 1.5. You start having a lot of trouble coping even at 2 degrees. And if you follow the current trajectory to something like 4, then really the planet becomes difficult to recognize. I mean, it's not only that you know, there's also more fragile biological systems like coral reefs, which are just long gone by even, a little more than 2. But human systems, it's really difficult to adapt or respond or cope with in any way sea level rise beyond a certain point, right? You can build a seawall and protect your most valuable assets for a small change. You cannot do so for a very, very large change, which is the kind of thing that we're likely to see if we lose big portions of Greenland or Antarctica.
I'm curious about something else. I'm hoping you can help me to understand better and our listeners. Is I had a conversation the other day with an educated person, a very smart person, professional, and I was mentioning this 10-year window, trying to explain what you just did quite eloquently, and he just said, "Well, that's just what some scientists think. You know, there are other scientists that, you know, they disagree. You know, it's like there's another side of this story." And can you give us a sense of the actual magnitude of the consensus in the scientific community on this and how that statement really, it seems to me to be ludicrous, and how would you answer someone who posed that to you?
Well, it's a good question and an interesting one. And the basic answer I would give is that when we actually look at people who have done research in this area and are extremely knowledgeable about it and have really spent, you know, their careers understanding what the data are telling us about climate change, there is about a 98% consensus. So yes, you might be able to find one or two that do not agree with this kind of conclusion. And if you watch C-SPAN or the nightly news, you know, where you only might have 2 people participating in a debate or 3 talking heads on a screen, then 1 or 2 looks like a good fraction. But in the real world of the scientific community, and this is not just in the United States, this is everywhere around the world, tends to be more than 97%, depending on the study, 97, 99, somewhere in there. But with the 1.5 degree report, actually, the interesting kind of anecdote related to what you just asked is that the only kind of pushback I received after, you know, working as one of the authors when the report came out, some other climate scientists said, you know, I think you're too optimistic. I think that the changes in this report, that the degree of change required within the next decade is just completely impossible. That this would require the entire world pivoting and radically transforming. And I don't know why you guys wrote this report, because I just don't think that's going to happen. And so the only, and that was a small fraction, but the only pushback I really got from fellow scientists was, this is such a hard, such a challenge to do the kind of things that you say need to be done for 1.5, that you probably should have just said, well, we should aim for 2.
So if, you know, if you could wave your magic wand and perhaps be the science advisor to a, let's put it this way, scientifically literate president, and leave it at that, what advice would you give them? What should we do in order to get ourselves gathered to meet the challenge of this 10-year window? Which reminds me of, you know, President Kennedy set the goal 50 some odd years ago to reach the moon in a decade. It seems to me that we should be able to do something if we set our minds to it, but that's the whole crux of the issue. But what would your advice be? What should we be doing?
Right. Well, I think we really could do an enormous amount to meet the challenge. And even if we got, you know, 90% of the way rather than 100, that'd still be fantastic. And what we really need to do, of course, is decarbonize the energy sector. And we need to convert most everything that's powered by fossil fuels, currently directly powered by fossil fuels, into using electricity. And that includes our motor vehicles. And what I would say a government, president, Congress, et cetera, should do is really try to emphasize to people that when we do this, not only do we mitigate climate change and prevent all these terrible consequences, but these are the same sources of our air pollution. So we get huge benefits for public health. We also get huge benefits for having quieter and more quieter cities, as we have electric vehicles and we have cleaner production, we use resources more efficiently. These things lead to cost savings. And, you know, we have spent something like, maybe $20 trillion over the century on fossil fuels, which is a technology that, despite all of that spending, provides us almost exactly the same efficiency as it did a century ago at about the same cost. And when we invest in renewables, we actually have seen the prices fall so dramatically that they're now, in most cases, cheaper than fossil fuels. And what we're getting for our money is we get something that's not just a substitute, it's actually an improvement. It's much better. Then it's better for its use of land that doesn't lead to, you know, coal ash spills and doesn't lead to gas explosions and doesn't lead to all the other harmful side effects of extractive fossil fuel industries. And we should account for those in a price on carbon is my ultimate way of solving this problem. You put a price on emissions from fossil fuels that really include the full spectrum of effects, that fossil fuels cause air pollution, fossil fuels cause climate change. These things really affect people. They affect all the other businesses, you know, that they suffer from their workers being sick from air pollution or it being very hot and, say, in construction or manufacturing, worker productivity goes down. So it's just kind of a burden imposed on the entire rest of the U.S. population and the rest of the U.S. economy from fossil fuels. And if we just make them pay their fair share and compensate for the burden by putting a price on their emissions, then I think naturally we would transition away. I mean, we are transitioning away from fossil fuels, but just too slowly. We're not going to get there within that 10 years like we need to. To speed it up, we need a price that really reflects the true damages from these emissions.
Yeah, we have to pay for the cost of using those fuels.
That's right. Instead of, I mean, really, somebody is paying, right? We're all paying with our insurance premiums and our healthcare premiums and the additional cost of all other manufactured products that are not fossil fuels because fossil fuels impose these burdens on everybody else.
Well, I'd like to finish this conversation kind of where we started, which is with the article by Alan Bias on the Global Climate Change NASA site. That's the Vital Signs of the Planet, climate.nasa.gov. And it's called A Degree of Concern, Why Global Temperatures Matter by Alan Bias. Tell us a bit about what it was like working with him and the value of working with a communicator like him in producing a document like this for the general public.
Oh, well, I think this kind of work is tremendous. And I think Alan Bias did a great job. We are very much constrained by our field when we write something like the UN report on climate change, that we just write the factual description of this is what the data says, right? This is why there's no controversy among the scientific community, really. This is what the data says. That's it. You know, the planet is warming. Here's what will happen based on scientific measurements, laboratory measurements, and, you know, observations as it keeps warming. It's very straightforward and factual, but the site really makes it something that people can get into, and they can see why these temperatures matter with some interesting examples about sea turtles. There are interesting interactive graphics where they can see some of the effects that, you know, I've just been talking about. Okay, well, rainfall will change and there'll be droughts and there'll be floods. And yeah, but where? Well, you can see it on this site. And so NASA has, of course, wonderful assets in observations and in modeling. And this, the climate.nasa.gov really does a great job at bringing all of those in a way that's both informative and really accessible to the general public. And I think that they are a wonderful complement to the kind of material that scientists like me produce.
Yeah, and I love the example of the sea turtle because he kind of draws on the analogy from the movie Finding Nemo about how the happy-go-lucky, you know, surfer dude sea turtle in there. Well, their lives are actually quite difficult, and a warming ocean will make them extremely difficult where they won't be happy-go-lucky at all.
That's right. And that's, you know, that's one of those really good examples where it sounds like it's not very much, just a half a degree, but biological systems can be affected. And, you know, the sea turtle is maybe not something that we all depend on daily, but, you know, bark beetles or weevils that eat your crops, if those suddenly can survive, you know, an extra winter as opposed to getting killed off by the frost, that affects us a lot too, right? And there's a lot of biological systems that are like that. So I think that was a great example. It's friendly, it's important, and he does a good job of making that clear.
Well, Drew Schindel, professor of climate sciences at Duke University, I want to thank you for spending this time with us and helping make this very complex issue a little easier to wrap our heads around. And thanks for spending the time with us today on Blue Dot.
My pleasure, Dave. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to atmospheric physicist Drew Schindel from Duke University. Check out Alan Bias' web article, A Degree of Concern, Why Global Temperatures Matter, on NASA's Global Climate Change website at climate.nasa.gov. When we come back from a short break, we'll find out about how the recently launched Deep Space Atomic Clock will help the next generation of deep space explorers when we talk to the principal investigator for the clock, Todd Ely. I'm Dave Schlohm, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Shlom. Our next guest is Todd Ely. He's the principal investigator for NASA's Deep Space Atomic Clock. It was one of the experiments launched on the SpaceX Falcon Heavy rocket on June 25th. About the size of a toaster, this clock has the capability to revolutionize future spaceflight by making it possible for spacecraft from future trips to Mars to space tourism flights to navigate themselves rather than relying on tracking and navigation from Earth. All right, and we are talking to Todd Ely. He is the principal investigator of the Deep Space Atomic Clock. And Todd, I have to say right off the bat that, like, you know, if you're at a cocktail party and somebody says, you know, well, what do you do, Todd? And you've got a beverage in your hand and you say, I'm the PI for the Deep Space Atomic Clock. That just sounds way cool.
Well, I like that. I like that you think it's cool. We worked hard to come up with our name. So we were trying to be evocative and give some context for what this clock is going to be used for, and hopefully you're duly impressed with that.
Yeah, it also sounds like it'd make a great, like, name for an album by a heavy metal band. Metallica's new release, Deep Space Atomic Clock.
It's funny that you actually say that, because you know, as we all are wont to do, we Google various things, and I Googled the Deep Space Atomic Clock often, and I actually ran across a small Latin American band that got the name, and they made it's kind of progressive rock that's just acoustical, and they made a song called Deep Space Atomic Clock. So I think it's kind of fun.
All right, well, let's get to, give us the Atomic Clock 101. I want you to explain to me how an atomic clock works compared to, say, the quartz wristwatch on my wrist. Why are atomic clocks so accurate?
So all atomic clocks start with a quartz crystal oscillator as the thing they're trying to control. As you know, a quartz oscillator creates an oscillation or signal using what's called a piezoelectric effect. So it's creating this thing that oscillates that we can then count those oscillations and produce, you know, a time from. But they all drift. That's because of mechanical imperfections in the quartz. And those things would prevent quartz oscillators from being used in deep space navigation on a routine basis. So we actually have, over the many years, developed atomic clocks and use atomic clocks in the deep space network to navigate our spacecraft. And the way in which atomic clocks work there, as well as in, say, the GPS program, they're based on some ion atom. Cesium atomic clocks, rubidium atomic clocks are routinely used in GPS today, and our atomic clock is based on a mercury ion. And we use a property of the atom, in our case, a mercury ion, and its ability to transition between two energy states and do so with extreme precision and stability. And so if you energize a mercury ion and get it excited from one energy state to next and do so with a very specific frequency, we can use that characteristic of the atom to use it like a tuning fork to stabilize a quartz crystal oscillator. And that's what we do with the Deep Space Atomic Clock. We have a mercury ions confined in electric fields in what we call an ion trap. And we energize those ions with signals from that quartz oscillator that's drifting around. And as we energize those ions, they will change their energy states. And the number that change energy states is a measure of how far off or close that quartz oscillator is to the frequency you want it to be at. And so now we've got this error signal, and we can take that error measurement and control, you know, put it in a feedback control system and produce a very stable frequency output, effectively taking out the drift that the quartz oscillator is introducing to the signal. And as a result, the output of the clock is extremely stable by many orders of magnitude, more so than that quartz oscillator.
Yeah, I found that fascinating that with a lot of atomic clocks, especially the early ones, is they're using atoms. And atoms are electrically neutral because they have the same number of protons, which are positively charged in the nucleus, and the same number of electrons, which are negatively charged in the orbital shells. But they will interact with the outer part of the container that they're in, and that causes error, from my understanding. But with this mercury ion clock that you guys have developed, like you said, you can trap that because it's got charge, and you can use it like an electrical trap. And I found that to be fascinating.
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. So rubidium clocks and cesium are neutral, and one of the big sources of drift in a rubidium atomic clock is the fact that the rubidium atoms impact the walls of the vapor cell that they're contained in. And with the deep space atomic clock, we can find a plasma of mercury ions using electric field, so they never interact with the walls. And so that's one of the key reasons why the deep space atomic clock is potentially going to be about 50 times more stable than the flying GPS atomic clocks today. Another reason why mercury ions are attractive is that transition frequency I talked about before is at 40.5 gigahertz, where with rubidium, it's on the order of 8 gigahertz. So it's a much higher frequency, and the result of which is with the deep space atomic clock, we can control that frequency adjustment much more precisely.
So that's like 40 billion oscillations per second.
That's correct.
Compared to like 8. Yeah, that's quite an order of magnitude higher. Give us a sense of how accurate this clock will be over a period of time compared to, say, you know, other types of clocks.
So our goal with our experiment in space that we just launched June 25th, 2:30 a.m. Eastern time, is to measure, characterize the clock and show that it hopefully will drift, gain or lose less than 3/10 of a nanosecond over the course of a day. And other ways to state that statistic are over the course of 10 years, gaining or losing less than a microsecond, and then over 10 million years, gaining or losing less than a second. So wow. It's very stable. And there's a fundamental reason why we need this kind of stability and why atomic clocks are used for deep space navigation. And that's because we use these clocks to measure the time it takes for a signal to travel from the tracking station to the spacecraft we're trying to track. And as you know, radio signals travel at the speed of light, which is 300,000 kilometers per second. And so to get accurate, you know, precision measurements of the distance between the tracking station and the spacecraft means we need to measure that those times to better than a nanosecond.
And that allows you to really pinpoint accurately where the spacecraft is and then, you know, navigate accordingly. So what will be some of the applications for this in the future, like trips to Mars, out to the moon? Where will we see the future deep space atomic clocks being used?
So, you know, as I mentioned earlier, we use atomic clocks in the Earth tracking stations today. And the way in which we utilize the radio signal going to the spacecraft and back as we measure the time that it takes to go up and back. And that round trip light time is what we measure with our ground-based atomic clocks. And then we take data over time and we can compute the trajectories of our spacecraft, but that's all a ground-based process. The reason why we have to turn the signal around is the clocks on board spacecraft today, which are usually based on quartz oscillators, are just not stable enough for us to make the measurements precisely and accurately that we need to do navigation. With the deep space atomic clock, there's enough stability now at the spacecraft that we would no longer need to turn that signal around. And it allows us near term to use the deep space network much more efficiently. So if you can imagine at a place like Mars, we have a number of spacecraft there today, and each of them requires a certain amount of tracking data to compute their trajectories. But because we use this two-way tracking scheme, basically you track one spacecraft at a time. If you're tracking one, you're not tracking another. You effectively are time-sharing the antenna. But if you could broadcast a signal to Mars and have atomic, you know, have clocks like the Deep Space Atomic Clock on board, every one of the spacecraft that could listen to that signal could collect tracking data with enough accuracy that would allow them to be able to navigate and produce those trajectories that we need to do to know where they're at and know where they're going. So we're no longer time sharing. At Mars, you could support an unlimited number of users as long as they had the clock on board. So that's a near-term thing. But the other way to think about it is if you're collecting the data on board and it's available on board, you could process it on board. You wouldn't necessarily need to send it back. And so that opens up the possibility of essentially a self-driving spacecraft. We could do autonomous navigation with that data and have it available for onboard use. And that has some really important applications, especially as humans begin traveling to further destinations to the moon and Mars, where they're going to need to have onboard navigation information that is accurate and timely, and a clock is a key component that would enable that.
Yeah, and you've mentioned the Deep Space Network, which are the giant radio telescopes around the world in places like Spain and Goldstone in Southern California and Australia. So what I'm gathering from this is you don't need to be dependent on them for your navigation. You're able to do it autonomously because of this deep space clock that you would have on board.
So it would still need some set of signals coming from various locations. And it would probably start with a signal sent from the Earth to a spacecraft headed to Mars. But you wouldn't have to wait for that signal to turn around, come back, and then be processed on the ground. So, you know, all of those delays are no longer a factor in the onboard navigation. And then, like GPS, if we think further out and we need to build up infrastructure at places like Mars or the moon where we have GPS-like tracking systems at those planets, the Deep Space Atomic Clock would be a core component of those systems. And those radio signals could begin from those satellites and be received by an incoming signal, or excuse me, an incoming spacecraft or a spacecraft in orbit. Much like we use the GPS system here at Earth. We use it not only to navigate, you know, on the ground with our phones to figure out where we're at, but we use GPS receivers on spacecraft today to determine orbits of spacecraft in orbit around Earth. And we could do a similar thing at other destinations like the moon and Mars, as well as not only doing that tracking function for spacecraft in orbit, but those that are coming to those destinations, much like an airplane landing at an airport. You know, they have Doppler radar systems that aid airplanes landing at airports. You would have tracking networks around these destinations, and they would all have signals originating from some future version of a deep space atomic clock. And those approaching spacecraft might also have deep space atomic clocks on board them to get the accurate, precise measurements that you would need to do the navigation that we need to do.
And of course, when these clocks are on spacecraft and they're moving, although not at like anything approaching the speed of light, but they are moving fast enough to orbit the Earth or to escape Earth's gravitational field if you're going to the moon or Mars, you also have to account for the time differences due to Einstein's theory of relativity, don't you?
That is correct. In fact, we do that today. For that two-way navigation that we do routinely with ground-based, you know, navigation engineers processing the data, we have to factor in special relativistic and general relativistic effects. If we didn't, we would never be able to get our spacecraft to the moon or Mars or further destinations. It's not as big of an effect as our standard, you know, Newtonian effects of gravity. But it's an important fact that if it wasn't there, we would totally miss our destinations. And so that remains true with the Deep Space Atomic Clock. To do the trajectory solutions, we would have to account for the fact that a clock on board a spacecraft is ticking at a different rate than a clock here on Earth.
Yeah, they're ticking slower, right?
For special relativistic effects, they tick slower. They actually tick a little faster due to general relativistic effects. So it's a balance between what's the speed of the spacecraft, where is it at in the gravity well of the planets that it's in orbit around or approaching. So it varies depending on where it's at in space.
Time is so much more complicated than we think it is.
It is. It's all part of the space-time continuum. So the time affects the trajectory and where we're at in space and vice versa.
And you mentioned the launch of the Falcon Heavy that launched several different experiments, including yours. That was January 25th at, 2:30 a.m. Eastern Time?
That's correct.
And were you there?
I was there. It was an amazing sight. I had expected a certain, experience, and I got that and more. I think the thing that struck me the most was I was expecting the rocket to roar off the ground, but it actually had this beating oscillation that you could feel in your chest. And long after you couldn't see the rocket anymore, since it was at night, you could obviously see the light show of the rocket going into orbit. It disappeared in the sky, but you could still hear it and you could still feel it. So it was really cool.
Yeah, because that's the biggest rocket that the U.S. has launched since the Saturn V that launched the astronauts to the moon 50 years ago.
That's what I've read.
Yeah, that's a big rocket, and it must have been a real thrill when you found out that your experiment had deployed. And is it working okay? Have you been able to check on it? Is everything going all right?
So 83 minutes after STP-2 launched, the General Atomics Orbital Testbed spacecraft, that's our host for the DSAC payload, was deployed off of the payload adapter ring on STP-2. And it went into orbit. And over the past, I guess it's a little over a week now, they've been bringing up the spacecraft and checking it out. And there's a few more weeks of that in front of us. We're not expecting to turn on the deep space time clock until the early August timeframe. So we don't have data on our mission yet, but we're getting closer and we're really looking forward to that. And then after we do turn on, we have about a month of where we're commissioning our payload, bringing it up slowly, checking it out, making sure things are working as we expect. And then we'll continue with a full year mission ending in August of 2020, where we characterize the clock's performance and also validate its utility for one-way navigation. As you can imagine, that's a complicated job. And in fact, we're actually going to collect data from the Global Positioning System, the GPS satellites that are in view of the orbital testbed spacecraft. We collect all of that data and we can process it to compute the solution for the clock, how far it's drifting from what we expect it to be, and get those statistics that would allow us to make those claims of, 0.3 of a nanosecond in a day. And that's our goal. We actually have ground-based test data that suggests that's what the clock is able to do, and we're hoping to repeat that in orbit. The other thing that we're going to do in space is we have a lot of data from the global positioning system that allows us to accurately compute the clock solution. But that is dissimilar from how we navigate spacecraft in deep space. So if you can imagine an orbiter at Mars in that scenario I described earlier, when we get two-way tracking, we get a single link between an Earth station and a spacecraft. Contrast that with a GPS, your solution in your phone from the GPS system, you're getting 4, 5, 6, or more spacecraft in view, a lot of tracking data. We don't have that luxury in deep space navigation. You usually have one link between the tracking station and the spacecraft, and you collect that data over time. And so what we want to do with our experiment in low Earth orbit is to try and mimic those characteristics that represent the kind of tracking data we get and the amount of tracking data that we get for deep space navigation for, say, a typical orbiter at Mars. So we call that an analog deep space navigation experiment. And that's the other key thing that we're trying to do with our low Earth orbit experiment that hopefully is starting in August.
Well, speaking of time, we're about out of ours, but I do appreciate you spending some of yours with us, and we'll check back with you in about a year and see how things went with the Deep Space Atomic Clock.
That's great, and thanks for having me. I've enjoyed talking about our upcoming mission.
All right. Todd Ely is the principal investigator of the Deep Space Atomic Clock, which launched on SpaceX's Falcon Heavy on June 25th at 2:30 a.m. exactly, right? Because you would know, being, you know, having those atomic clocks.
That's true.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, Todd.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks again to our guests, Todd Ely, the principal investigator for NASA's Deep Space Atomic Clock, and Drew Schindel, an atmospheric physicist and climate scientist. You can check out the article, A Degree of Concern, Why Global Temperatures Matter, by Alan Bias on NASA's Global Climate Change website, climate.nasa.gov. And a special thanks to Alan Bias. Alan is not only the author of the article, he's also a longtime friend of Blue Dot, and he's lined up countless interviews with NASA Earth scientists over the years. In fact, he was the one who facilitated us having Dr. Drew Schindel on for this show. NASA media specialists don't do interviews. Their job is to line up scientists for people in the media, like me, to interview. But this article was so well written and such a clear science communication piece on the most important issue of our time, climate change, that I wanted to give him a big shout out. So thanks, Alan. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this or past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We're distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.